Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm good. A little crazed, but good.
I hear you've been busy.
It's been a nutso week for all the weather. You know, I had my sunroof open this week, and the next day, I was freezing to death. I don't know what's going on. I think we need to call Bill McKibben.
Had some snow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but not really enough to do, like, skiing or snowshoeing or whatever, because it's warming up again.
Yeah, the temperatures are just oscillating back and forth. I have no idea what this winter is going to turn out to be like. I guess we just have to watch and see.
Well, and then you've got the West Coast, which is like really freaking out. They're getting as much snow in one day as they get all year.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
They don't know what to do with that stuff.
No, they put chains. I was watching the news and everybody puts chains on. Brian explained it to me. It was like, yep, I understand it, but chains are cheaper. Nobody has snow tires.
Sure. Yeah, if that's the only time you use it, then I guess it's a good solution.
So I take it you're riding indoors.
I am indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
any day outside during the winter is a bonus. That's the way I look at it.
That's
so
true.
I don't get too disappointed when I can't ride outside in the wintertime because it's not expected. So.
No, but, you know, most people around here are, okay, I got to get one day every month.
You know, that's me.
Okay, there you have it.
Well, I got January out of the way, so now I'm good until February.
Yeah.
Okay.
February. That's coming up, like, really fast.
Yeah, and you know what else is in February? Radiothon.
Oh, that's right.
Mid-February, Radiothon.
Gosh. It's been a year?
It's been a year.
Oh, my goodness.
It has been a whole year since we put the bite on our listeners to contribute some cash to WJCU.
And to help support the station.
That's right. So more about that in coming weeks, but just wanted to give you a heads up, Radiothon is coming.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay.
I'll be here.
All right.
You know, want to know what's coming up on today's show?
Yes.
Oh, okay. We have three interviews today. Two quickies and an in-depth conversation with Glenn Eames.
Okay.
Who is Glenn Eames, you say? He's the proprietor of a shop called The Old Spokes Home. Isn't that an awesome name?
Yeah.
Probably the place they're going to send me when they put me out to pasture, the old spokes. Well, maybe not. Anyway, I learned about Glenn from our buddy Steve Garrow. I wanted to talk with him because, like me, he wears a whole bunch of bicycling hats. He owns a traditional bike shop. It also houses a vintage bike shop. And there's a vintage bike museum.
Hmm.
All in one of the coolest places, Burlington, Vermont.
Oh.
Yeah. Glenn's going to talk about all of that as well as a bit about the restoration work he does. So, yeah, he's sort of, you know, this jack of all bike trades.
Nice.
Then we're going to talk with our friend Steve Frothingham, who is the online editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. This time, you know that the verdict came down with Specialized and Velagi last week. Well, he was there every step of the way.
Oh, okay.
So he's going to tell us more about the outcome and enlighten us as to what the future ramifications of this lawsuit might be. It's interesting what, you know, the chatter that's going on all over the bike industry.
Interesting.
And then last year, you remember, we talked with Mark Griffin, Mr. Skinny Tire Festival in Moab.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming up again.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to talk to him again because I fell in love with this idea of the moonlight ride.
Yeah.
But I think there's some new things coming up. And, of course, since I never think of Utah as mountain bike country, I'm still wrapping my head around the skinny tire thing. So we'll
You always think of Utah as mountain bike
country. Oh, yes. I never think of it as road bike country.
That's right.
You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm backwards.
There is a lot of road cycling.
And, evidently.
St. George has a triathlon, an Ironman, actually.
And a moonlight ride, too.
Yeah.
So we have some news. Actually, there's some interesting news this week.
All right.
So let's welcome Glenn Eames to the Outspoken Cyclist. Good evening, Glenn. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, you're very welcome, and thanks for having me as a guest. It's really an honor.
Thanks. So social media is pretty amazing. That's how I found you and your shop. which has a great name, the Old Spokes Home. I figured that's where they're going to send me when they send me out the pasture. Tell us a little bit about the shop, you know, where you're located and how long you've been there, and basically what you do, which is pretty interesting.
Well, we're located in Burlington, Vermont, and I tell people we've been here since the turn of the century, which is true because we started in the year 2000.
Got it.
And mostly what we do is recondition used bicycles. That's the biggest percentage of our business. Of course, we do a lot of repairs as well.
Right.
In trying to make, you know, maintain the flow of used bicycles to our customers, we took on a couple of bike lines, which have been very good for us. So we do have a couple of bike lines. One of the bigger lines is Surly Bicycles. They offer a couple of bikes that really work for our customers, and then we're a Jamis dealer and KHS dealer.
Yeah, so Surly, like the long-haul trucker and those kind of bikes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're actually doing quite well, believe it or not, with this lack of snow, with the snow bikes, the Pugsley and the Moonlander.
Yeah, well, I guess we're going to get snow eventually, although it looks like the West Coast is getting it before we are this year. Tell us a little bit about this whole vintage thing. You do restorations, too.
Well, we do. You know, again, a lot of the bikes that we sell are used. A lot of the product that we sell are used three-speed bicycles from the 40s, 50s, 60s during the first part of the bike boom that took place right after the Second World War. And a lot of those bikes are now popular. There are three universities in town, including the University of Vermont. And a lot of students appreciate a bike like this as kind of like a campus cruiser or an inexpensive kind of cool way to get around town. We also sell them to a lot of regular adults, not just students.
What do you do for parts? So we're talking things like Sturmey Archer hubs and trigger controls and indicator chains and all these things that, you know, you can't necessarily, or can you? I haven't even thought about it necessarily buy anymore.
Well, you can buy some of this stuff. Sturmey Archer was bought out by some folks. They've changed hands a number of times. They're no longer an English company. And you can buy replacement repair parts for the old Sturmey Archer AW hub, which was introduced in the late 30s and kind of became the standard for most three-speed bikes, you know, right up until the present.
Right.
But being the old spokes home, a lot of these old parts kind of migrate this way. So we have a pretty good repository of vintage three-speed parts. Now, a lot of folks kind of think of us as the place for like a single-speed cruiser, like the balloon tire bikes that, you know, became pretty popular in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But I'll tell you, we do have a few of those. We recondition them for people and make them available. But most folks take them for a spin, especially in the hills of Burlington, and just find that a geared bike is much more practical.
Sure. In Vermont, yeah, I would guess so.
Yeah.
So, well, are you on the water anywhere?
Well, we're close to the lake.
Okay.
You know, it's Lake Champlain is considered like, you know, the unknown Great Lake, but we're just a few miles from the shore. There's a wonderful bicycle path that traverses the shore up into the northern towns over this beautiful bike trail. There's a bike ferry that's a portion of it, and part of it is built right out onto Lake Champlain. It's an old causeway that was built at the turn of the century. Pretty nice.
We were up there, I'd say, maybe 3 years ago, and we're on a boat, and we were at a wedding in Burlington.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great spot.
It really is. Have you always lived in Vermont?
No, I moved here. I moved here with my partner. She and I did a round-the-world bicycle tour in the early 80s, and prior to leaving for that tour, we had lived in the state of New Hampshire. I grew up in New England, outside of Boston. So we had toured through here, loved the lake, Lake Champlain, and the city of Burlington, kind of really mixed with the politics here, and thought about moving here. Then we took this round-the-world bicycle tour. We spent a couple of years on our bikes, which is another story.
Yeah, I guess so. One I missed somehow.
Yeah, but we wound up meeting a woman who was in the Peace Corps when we were traveling through North Africa. We went through Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. We were in Morocco. We wound up kind of being marooned on the Morocco-Algerian border for about 3 or 4 months. My partner, Mary, was ill with hepatitis A.
Oh.
And so we convalesced there. We wound up running a English language bookstore in Oujda, Morocco, and met a woman who wound up taking a job here at UVM. So when we came back to the States, finishing our trip, she was the perfect person to come and couch surf at while we looked for work in one of our favorite cities, Burlington.
What a great story.
Yeah, it was a good, it really, really worked out. I came here with the intention of opening the bike shop that I now operate. I wasn't going to call it the old spokes home, but I was hoping to deal in vintage bikes and have a number of stands where people could work on their own bike if they wanted to, used parts, deal mostly with transportation, and hopefully display some of the history that I had accumulated a little bit prior to leaving. But I wound up, when I came to Burlington, I wound up taking a job at one of the local larger bicycle shops and then wound up being part owner there and stayed there for about 14 years before I finally left in the late 90s and decided to open the old spokes home in the year 2000.
So you came round to it again.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I really like the whole concept of having people work on their bikes. And now, do you allow that?
Yeah. If, you know, we screen people because we don't want somebody, you know, paying by the hour to destroy their own bike. And
or your tools.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, sometimes it's hard to tie a mechanic up. So we do allow that. We don't get a lot of it. There's a class going on in the back of my shop right now.
Yeah.
And so we encourage people to be self-sufficient as much as they possibly can, because the bicycle, as you know, is a pretty simple machine once you, you know, unravel some of its mysteries.
Are you seeing a big increase in the transportation part of your business now?
It absolutely leaps and bounds. I mean, that is my business.
Awesome.
If you walked into the old spokes home, you would not see a single, on the showroom floor, which isn't that substantial, but you wouldn't see a single front suspension bike, let alone a dual suspension bike, nor any really carbon fiber kitted out road bikes.
Right.
And I don't say that, you know, looking down my nose and snickering at those, because they're great bikes. I've worked on them. We work on them here, we ride them and love them, but our primary focus is, I would say, bicycle touring, kind of adventure road riding, if you will, and commuters. Commuters are probably our biggest user.
When you say adventure touring, are you doing any randonneuring stuff?
That's what we do. We do, you know, a little bit, I guess I would call it dirt road biking.
Yep.
It's a kind of up-and-coming class of its own, if you will. I noticed that Brain, the bicycle retailer industry newsletter, highlighted on the front page of their publication this past time it came around. And people are, you know, it's funny how people went from old three speeds or cruisers into the first bike boom in the late 70s and really picked up, we called them 10 speeds or drop bar road bikes, really stripped down lightweight bikes, and then kind of morphed and migrated into the mountain bike when it made the scene. Not everybody was riding them off road. They were kind of a practical, upright transportation sort of bike, and a hybrid, which was kind of the best of both worlds, or cross bike. No, not cyclocross, but kind of a cross between a mountain and a road bike. And now they've come full circle back to road bikes, but they're realizing the beauty, especially in New England here, of riding on a lot of the back dirt roads and mixing it up with pavement and dirt. You can go out on a road ride here and spend 60 miles and, say, mix up you know, a good 50% of it on beautiful dirt roads, lots of little historical places to pit stop, old graveyards, foundations, swimming holes and that, and then mix it up back on the paved road and really be away from traffic.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Glenn Eames from the Old Spokes Home in Burlington, Vermont. We have a bike shop in Northeast Ohio, and that's we focus on the longer distance rider, and I see it coming around again too. I think it's awesome. Just awesome.
Bikes that can accommodate fenders and much wider tires.
Exactly.
The stuff we stripped off when we were kids.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Let's talk a little bit about your vintage bikes and your museum.
Sure.
How many vintage bikes do you know how many you have?
Ooh, boy, you know what? That's a good question. I really don't know. You know, when you have the collector mania madness,
right.
It comes and goes and flows. You know, I would say there's a good 30-plus bicycles on display here. And if your listeners want to go to oldspokeshome.com, there is a full page of the museum that, you know, we're not really an official museum. We like to call ourselves one. But we have a good display of cycling history that chronicles the development of the machine from just after the Civil War, 1867 or so, up until about 1902, when the bicycle really reigned supreme, and just chronicles the kind of development and change as they went through that four-decade process.
So how did you come by these different examples of this these periods of time?
Well, you know, it's like anything, like any mania. I've always loved history. It's always fascinated me. I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a little, you know, a kid. But anyway, went in a different direction. And I discovered cycling history by accident, just before I took that round-the-world bicycle trip. Must have been 1981 or so. I picked up copy of Bicycling magazine. It was a winter issue, and they did an issue on cycling history and some of the artifacts that one might find if they looked around local antique shops or whatever. And I had always, I'd known about or seen pictures of high wheel bicycles and people with striped shirts, and just assumed, I didn't even really delve into it, that these people were, you know, some sort of acrobat or circus performer. But the bicycle really was a transformative instrument for me. It changed my life from a cigarette smoking couch potato to a active rider. I loved the bicycle, and then I discovered the history of cycling, picking up this Bicycling magazine article, and I decided, geez, I wonder if any of this stuff is still around. And lo and behold, right in the town that I was living in at the time, Laconia, New Hampshire, a little sporting goods store up the street run by an older man. He was a chain-smoking cigarette smoker, and he had a penny farthing in the shop on display. It was a sporting goods bicycle, and you could get your basketballs and footballs, hockey equipment and bike stuff. But anyway, he had one of these things in there, and that was it. There's a national organization called the Wheelmen. I became a member and then really started looking around. And fortunately for me, I lived in the Northeast, which was the center for industrial development in the late 19th century. So a lot of this stuff still survived. And I was able to find quite a few things. And then my focus, you know, when you start collecting things, you love everything. You
right.
fall in love with all of it. And so I was just, the stuff seemed to be finding me. I wound up taking that trip for a couple of years and put what I had collected in storage. This was 1982. And came back to the States, worked as a bike messenger in San Francisco for about a year, and settled in Burlington. And I got the stuff back out of storage. And then I started going through the things I had as I continued to collect things, and had the dream of sometime being able to display a kind of technological progression of that 40-year time period, late 1860s to the turn of the last century.
So are they all on display? I mean, could somebody come in and actually see this progression and see each of these pieces?
They could. And again, you can go online and see these. I would say, you know, of what is displayed on my site, most of the antique pre-1900 things are here on display. And we've created a timeline in front of the display, like a visual timeline, and
sure.
You can trace the progression, and you can actually see the machines.
Cool.
Yeah.
I guess one of the weird questions that came up for me is, what is the weirdest bike you have?
Well,
do you have one that you consider kind of weird?
There are a couple. You know, I guess. Since people were trying to solve the problem of transporting themselves in various ways during that, 40-year time span,
right.
They came up with a bunch of different solutions. One of the weirdest ones is an 1897 Crypto Alpha Bantam. Now, that was the name of the bicycle.
Nice name.
And it's a small bike. The front wheel is 24 inches in diameter, and the rear wheel is 22 inches in diameter.
Huh.
And it's propelled by pedaling the front hub, kind of like a high wheeler. But this is a very small bike. Two parallel tubes, a top tube and then a parallel crossbar. And the front hub is a planetary hub. They called it a crypto-geared hub back in the day. And
yep.
What it is a sun gear on the central axle with four planetaries rotating around it inside this hub shell. And what it does is, in effect, it gears up that 24-inch wheel to be like a 52-inch diameter front wheel.
Interesting.
Now, you probably know that... term gear inches, because we're all different heights and different length legged humans would ride a different diameter front wheel.
Uh-huh.
So everybody wanted to push the biggest wheel they could, because it would be the faster you go, the bigger the wheel you had, the faster you would go.
Sure, that makes sense.
So this little planetary geared thing was a pretty odd machine, the Crypto Alpha.
And so what do you think, other than that, is the most interesting machine? I mean, if you were to take your collection and say, this is the one that stands out as just an amazing example of human ingenuity and bicycling, do you have one that you really like that?
Let me see. You know, you're asking somebody who's never found a bicycle.
He didn't like
love. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that maybe it's an unfair question.
Each of them has a unique feature and aspect about it. They have unusual names. There's one called an Extraordinary Challenge.
Huh.
It was made by the Singer Company, and they made the. They were an English company. There was the British Special Challenge, and the Extraordinary has two levers that kind of help you crank the front wheel, and you position the rider back. The front fork is raked really forward, so you wouldn't pitch over the handlebars
right.
if you happen to hit something.
Interesting.
That's a pretty interesting bike. All of these. I tell everybody who comes in to see them that it's basically rideable sculpture because they're beautiful to look at. I think just about every bicycle is.
So are you open year-round?
We are. We're open year-round. We reduce our hours in the winter time. We're open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 until 6. And this time of year, it's pretty quiet.
Sure.
You know, it just comes in spurts. We're quite busy in the spring, summer, and fall.
Sure. How many people work at Old Spokes Home?
There's five employees plus myself right now. They're working probably a four-day shift.
Yeah.
One fellow works five. And then in season, there is myself and 10 or 11 mechanics working.
Wow. So you're plenty busy.
Yeah, we keep pretty busy. You know, we try to... It's tough to tell somebody they have to wait a couple of weeks to get their bicycle, but unfortunately it even happens here, even with all those people working.
Sure.
A lot of people riding bikes.
You know, when you do the right thing and you're good at what you do, people are willing to wait for it.
We hope so.
Yeah. Well, Glenn, this has been delightful to talk to you about the Old Spokes Home. So one more time, it's oldspokeshome.com.
Yes, yep.
And people can stop by your place Tuesdays through Saturdays this time of year?
Yep, they can come by Tuesday through Saturday, and I'd be happy to, you know, share my collection with them, some of the highlights. There's, you know, like I say, there's a self-guided little piece for them, but always love to share the history.
Well, I really am interested, and the next time we're in Vermont, we go to the Adirondacks quite often, and it's not that far.
Uh-huh. No, maybe that's a great pit stop.
We'll stop up and see you.
That sounds great.
Well, thanks, Glenn. I hope you have a great 2012 season.
Thank you, Diane.
And,
you too.
And have a great evening.
Hey, thanks again for inviting me. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Glenn Eames from the Old Spokes Home joined us from Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah. Isn't that a cool name?
Yes, it is. It sounds like a cool shop, too.
I know. Really a nice guy.
Yeah, that's one to visit. Well, we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
And savor that moment for a minute. And we will come back with a couple more guests and some news right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., John Carroll University is pleased to present Looking at Our Past, Examining Our Present, Creating Our Future, a celebration of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with legendary civil rights leader Diane Nash. A founding member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960, Nash led key civil rights campaigns in Nashville and across the South. More information at jcu.edu.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to take a bit of a different direction here.
Yes.
Talk to an industry insider.
Out west.
About something that just recently happened in the bicycle business.
Yes, it did. And it was public knowledge. So let's welcome the editor of Bicycle Retailer and IndustryNews.com, Steve Frothingham, back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Good evening, Steve. Great to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
Yeah? Okay. Last Friday, well, actually a week ago Friday, there was a verdict in the trial of Specialized Bicycle Products versus Velagi Bicycles. Can you back us into this case a little bit and the outcome and, most importantly, what you see as the results that are going to affect both Specialized and Velagi going forward?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the story really started at Interbike in 2010, and that's where Velagi first showed their new line of road bikes. And I have to say, I was there, and I stumbled across Velagi's little booth, and I thought the bike was the most interesting bike at the show that year.
Really?
I also thought it looked an awful lot like a Specialized.
Hmm.
And when I found out that Choi and the two co-founders, Robert Choi and Harley Forsman, had each left Specialized a few weeks earlier, and I got their brochure and it had a Morgan Hill address on it, I thought that was kind of weird. And apparently some of the Specialized people had the same reaction because they filed suit against Velagi just a few weeks after the show that year.
This has been going on.
Most people didn't know about that suit until 3 weeks ago, but the litigation has been going on since October 2010.
Ah, so most of us did not know that. And everything I've read and everything I've seen, I didn't realize. Of course, these things take a while to develop and all of the discovery and all of the writing and all of the back and forth. So it doesn't surprise me that it's been since 2010, but I don't think that was public knowledge much until now for me.
Right. Right.
So then there was something that I read that the idea for the Roubaix, which was the bike I think that Specialized said had been copied, came from another Specialized ex-employee who was riding a Custom 7. So, you know,
yeah.
Go ahead. It's been an interesting kind of journey. So what's next? What happened after that? After the trial?
As I understand it, during the course of the litigation, Specialized made as many as 9 separate claims against Balaji. But by the time it went to the jury last Thursday, it was down to just 1 claim, which was pretty simple. It was just breach of contract by Troy and Forsman. So the jury just had to decide whether those two had broke a contract with Specialized by working for a competitive company during the time that they were still under contract with Specialized. And the jury decided that Troy had breached his contract and that Forsman had not.
Interesting that they would pick one over the other. And what do you know why they chose Robert Choi as the one who broke his contract and not Barley Forsman?
I think Choi was, I hope I don't have this wrong, but I think Choi was there longer.
Okay.
I think Choi only left Specialized in August of 2010. And, of course, the bike was at Interbike, you know, third week of September.
Yeah, interesting.
And I think that's what raised eyebrows among some people was not only does the bike look like a Specialized, but, gee, you were only working for Specialized 5 weeks ago, and how did you come up with a brand-new bike in 5 weeks?
Which, of course, is impossible.
Yeah, and the bike at the show wasn't rideable.
It was a prototype.
It was a mock-up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So let's talk for just a second about what the jury did, which was hand down this kind of half-cocked verdict that said, yeah, Choi, you breached this contract. And by the way, you need to pay Specialized $1. What the heck message was that?
It's hard to say. The jury foreman spoke to the media, and he said that the jury believed that there were damages to Specialized, but they could not agree on the amount. And, of course, in a civil trial like this, they can't deliberate for days and days like they might in a criminal trial.
True.
So they had to come up with a number.
yeah, but come on.
And what exactly their motivation was, I don't know. Certainly, Balaji has tried to spin it in the press, in the social media, as a slap in the face at Specialized.
Well, it looks like it.
Maybe it is. And then Specialized, of course, is saying that the case was all about the principle of the thing, and that as far as they're concerned, Choi was found liable. They weren't going after money anyway.
Yeah.
But there was no money. Balaji is a startup company. Even if they brought Balaji to its knees, you can't get water from a stone there. So
that's true.
It wasn't like Specialized was going to walk away with millions from this.
So how many?
Even under the best scenario.
So do you think people are looking at it like David and Goliath?
Oh, definitely.
All right.
Yeah. In the bike world, as you know, there's a lot of sympathy for the underdog.
Yes.
Particularly an underdog that has a really interesting bike. And by all accounts, Robert Choi and Forsman are very nice guys. They certainly have been in my conversations with them. So it's very easy to be sympathetic towards their situation.
So going forward, I mean, I know these guys sort of mortgaged their houses to the hilt. That's what they said. And they
sold their houses, actually.
Oh, they did sell them. And they couldn't.
As I understand it, they're both renting now. They had sold their houses.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you like the bike?
Oh yeah. You know, it's a bike that suits the kind of riding I like. So it's certainly a bike that caught my eye. Of course, I think the Specialized Roubaix also suits my style of riding, and I've lusted after both bikes. I don't own either.
Yeah.
I think that Troy says he's going to prepare to sue to recover his legal fees, which I think were probably close to $500,000 by the end.
Yeah.
And Specialized says that, Mike Senior says he'd really rather put it behind him, but obviously they're going to defend themselves if Balaji tries to recover their legal fees. And I suspect Specialized has good lawyers and they'll defend themselves aggressively. And that could include, a countersuit.
I would have thought that legal fees would have come up in the civil case now with the decision. Why wouldn't that have been included with this decision at the right at the outset? Why would they start over? That's well, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
No, I'm not either. As I understand it, both sides could seek recovery because the ultimate verdict arguably could be seen as a victory for either side. So either side is open to try to recover. And
yeah.
Also some of the claims that Specialized had made about intellectual property and some other things were dismissed at Specialized's request, and Specialized technically could refile those, which
I
could
see.
Give them some ammunition if they do have to defend against Joy trying to recover, or Velaji trying to recover their legal fees.
Well, and I know Velaji has a patent on this frame,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know how that...
They have a design patent on the seat stay design.
Okay.
A longbow design.
Right.
Which
right.
isn't as strong as a utility patent.
Okay.
But it's worth something. I think they've applied for a utility patent as well.
So are you going to continue to watch this story?
Certainly. You know, I mean, it's news for us. I guess I have a little sympathy for both sides. I'd like to see them I'd like to see it end
sure.
Have Velaji make some interesting bikes and have Specialized make some interesting bikes and have them spend their money on things that would support the sport of cycling rather than supporting lawyers.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks for filling us in on it. I appreciate it. It's an interesting story. You know, there have been other lawsuits in our industry going back many, many years, but usually they're product liability and stuff like this. This was a little different.
Yeah, there are very few cases that I'm aware of that have gone all the way to a trial.
Right.
To a jury.
Right. Well, I'm going to let you get back to whatever you're doing this evening, Steve. Thanks so much for filling us in on the Specialized versus Velaji case.
Sure, thanks. I hope that helps.
It will. Have a great night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Steve Frothingham, the editor of Bicycle Retailer Industry News, joined us from the Republic of Boulder out there in Colorado.
Yes, he did. Again, thank you very much,
Steve. Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Interesting insight on that lawsuit.
Yeah. I learned some things.
Yeah, hard to believe they weren't cooking this up while they still were drawing a paycheck from Specialized if it was just 5 weeks.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I suppose anything's possible, but
yeah,
not plausible in my opinion.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the big guys at Interbike don't go to Interbike. Trek mm-hmm. doesn't go to Interbike. Specialized
mm-hmm.
does, though.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I don't really remember Velaji. Obviously, they probably just... If they're a little tiny startup, they didn't have a big flashy booth.
Yeah.
They probably had just this prototype mock-up frame.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if their design and their subsequent production bikes take off in a meaningful way or if they win this suit and then disappear into bicycle history.
Well, we'll find out.
A little footnote.
Stay tuned, as we say in the business.
A little footnote in bicycle history, perhaps.
Yeah.
I don't know. So you have some news for us.
I do. Okay. I have some nice news this week. You remember when we spoke with Leslie Bohm a couple of weeks ago about how the bicycle industry could get a few pointers from the NRA?
Yeah.
So I didn't know the story would grow some legs, but it did. This week, Tom Bowden, who is a bike commuter from Richmond, Virginia, as well as a corporate lawyer with an MBA and a conservative,
mm-hmm.
caught that ball, ran downfield with it on Commute by Bike this week.
Oh, okay.
Aha. So his article is very thorough. He did talk to Leslie. He also talked to somebody else who had done some other stuff with the NRA. But here's some things that were pretty enlightening that Tom said. The NRA simply portrays guns as a part of everyday life.
Okay.
And for many of their members, they truly are. The NRA is consistent in its message. Guns are good. Guns are patriotic. Whether you and I agree with that is a different story.
Of course,
this is the NRA.
Mm-hmm.
We cyclists, on the other hand, send mixed messages. We trumpet the health virtues of cycling while we squabble over mandatory helmet laws because everyone knows cycling is dangerous. For Pete's sake, wear a helmet. Oh, my God, if you don't, you'll splatter your brains all over the road and I'll have to pay for it in our single-payer healthcare system. But You'll have a beautiful corpse and you'll be a very good organ donor. This guy is hilarious. He also goes on to add, one challenge to cyclists in adopting NRA-style tactics is that we have so many organizations. And this has always been my beef. The NRA, whether by luck or design, was pretty much the only game in town at the national level, to my knowledge. This is what Tom's saying. That helps them control the message and the debate. Cyclists have the League of American Bicyclists, Bikes Belong, the Alliance for Biking and Walking, NORBA, USA Cycling, Ultra Marathon Cycling Association, and others. Not exactly monolithic. Mm-hmm. I think that's a problem for us. So Tom is scheduled to be on the show in the not-too-distant future. I think it's going to be an interesting interview, and he's a conservative, after all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The diversity of types of people in cycling, I think, is one of its strengths, or is one of the things that appeals to me, because you have so many different groups of cyclists doing different things. Mountain, road, tri, commuting, blah, blah, blah. So I would hate to see it get homogenized, but I do see the point that it's very fragmented, and unlike the NRA, it diffuses its influence because of that. So it's both a strength and a weakness, depending on which way you're looking at it.
Well, the NRA looks at what it is an organization that says guns are good.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of people own guns and shoot guns and target practice and whatever. It can be anybody from a cyclist to a doctor. So we have all kinds of people who ride bicycles, and all we really want to say is bicycling is good.
Yeah.
And so I can see the analogy I can see it very easily, how they could be compared to one another in a positive way.
And the NRA focuses on starting gun owners young with gun safety and hunting and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
That parallels right along with what we should be doing in bicycling with children.
Very good point. Very good point.
All right. Now we move on.
We're moving on. So from one of my favorite sites, grist.org, this appeared on January 17th, which, by the way, was my daughter's birthday.
Oh.
Swedish cities could connect via bicycle superhighway. This was by a woman named Sarah Laskow. In Sweden, city planners and the country's traffic authority are looking into building a four-lane bike superhighway between the university town of Lund and Malmö, Sweden's third largest city and one of its most diverse. Yes, cities like London have invested in protected lanes that they call bike superhighways, but this one would be one of the first to connect two cities, you know, like an actual highway.
Hmm.
The designs for the trail have it following the path of railway tracks protected from wind by fences and hedgerows. In both cities, biking's a popular form of transportation. Malmö's just across the water from Copenhagen, and they're not too far from each other, about 12.5 miles. That means the highway wouldn't be so much longer than some of the more ambitious London routes linking the outer burbs to the inner city, but 12.5 miles also makes for a very doable ride and an uber-sustainable way to get from one place to another. Isn't that nice? I think it's going to be cool. And, of course, they probably will do it, by the way. This comes from Bicycle Times. Celebrities actually do have lives other than being a celebrity. So British TV star is riding to the South Pole. Actually, I think she is just about done now. Submitted by Adam Newman on Monday the 16th, British TV personality Helen Skelton is known for her daring adventures. A 2,000-mile kayak trip, ultramarathons, high-wire tightrope walking. But this winter, she may top them all with a 500-mile bike ride to the South Pole. As of today, she's about 100. This was written on the 16th, so she's probably there. As of today, she's about 150 miles from her destination, making good use of an amazing bike that was specially built for the task. Designed and built by Hannebrink, Hannebrink, for the most difficult terrain, it features 20-inch wheels with 200-centimeter-wide tires that run at extremely low air pressure. No kidding. The aluminum frame has a long wheelbase for traction and stability. Other features are designed to handle the extreme cold, such as the mechanical disc brake. Hydraulic fluid becomes unusable at extremely low temperatures. Mm-hmm. That doesn't surprise me. The leather saddle. Plastic would freeze and shatter, and simple pedals with large straps to fit over heavy expedition boots. There's a more extensive article about Ms. Skelton and the bicycle at bbc.co.uk.
Now's the time to get your cycling in Antarctica, you know, because it's summer.
Yes, but
so
I think it's still pretty cold. Right?
Oh, well, it's all relative, you know?
I guess. So this is from the Bicycling Brings Jobs Department. Cycling nonprofit expanding downtown Missoula building. Now, we talked to Jim Serra not too long ago, the executive director of Adventure Cycling, and he never mentioned this. But it's Kailas Baller of the Missoulian posted on Monday. A construction worker continues demolition of the rooftop Monday at Adventure Cycling on Pine Street, where workers are nearly set to begin building a 1,400 square foot addition to the nonprofit's facility. So they're adding 1,400 square feet, which means people are working.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, yes. Adventure Cycling, which bills itself as the premier bicycle travel organization in North America, began construction in October to expand its 6,000 square foot facility. With his fingers crossed, Director Jim Serra said Monday he anticipates the project is on track and on budget. They will be able to increase their staff of 30 by 50%. See, so now jobs, again, jobs. Mm-hmm. Bicycling creates jobs.
And when was the last time a bike-related business sprung a leak and spilled toxic anything all over the ground or the water?
Well, I can reach back into my memory and not find any time.
Yeah, see, my point exactly.
Yes.
It's a pretty safe job creator, job creators go.
Yes, that's true. All right, I have one more story, and it's my favorite of the week. It also comes from Bicycle Times. It's about an artist who takes bicycle chains and turns them into fine art, and I mean fine. Korean artist turns bicycle chains into human forms. It was submitted by Adam Newman of Bicycle Times on January 11th. Korean artist, and I hope I say his name right, Seo Young-duk, has created some amazing sculptures from different types of chains, including bicycle chains. The sculptures depict the human form in life-size and large-scale formats. The exhibition Dystopia is currently on display at the INSA/ARCO Arts Center in Seoul, Korea. I'm telling you, if you have a moment, just type in bicycle chain human forms or art. Mm-hmm. There's a 4-minute video that accompanies this blurb. And I'll tell you what, these are some of the most beautiful sculptures I've ever seen, even without using bicycle chains. But when they come up close to them and one of them, the chains are all rusted. So it gives it this beautiful sort of bronze patina on it. Just beautiful stuff.
Cool.
I'd like one. We have a kind of an interesting collection of art memorabilia at home. And I would love to add one of these, but I'll bet I couldn't afford it in 5 million years. So that's my news for the week.
All righty then.
Okay.
Well, we've got one more guest.
Yes,
we
do.
Go back out toward the west.
And we're going to talk with Mark Griffith from the Skinny Tire Festival in Moab, Utah. Mark, thanks for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Hey, it's all my pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah, so it's been just over a year. I looked back to see when we did our last interview, and we spoke about your Skinny Tire Festival, which intrigued me then, and it intrigues me still. Tell me how last year went first.
Well, we had a great time in the desert last year. Of course, weather is always the big crowd pleaser, so second weekend in March, we have just wonderful weather here. So we had lots of sunshine. That was nice. And we had a great opener for one of our routes. We finished what we call the Moab Canyon Trail, which is a section of specifically paved bicycle path that connects Moab to one of our favorite rides out to Dead Horse Point. So we were able to ride that nice, smooth pavement all by ourselves, no cars.
Cool.
Very, very delightful.
And how long is that route?
It's a little over 60 miles.
Awesome. Without cars?
Well, what we have is about a 10-mile section from Moab to the highway. But once we get to the Dead Horse Point Highway, it's a nice wide road with a great shoulder, emergency lane, very little traffic out in that area. You would think, oh, my gosh, with that kind of landscape, why isn't everybody here? I don't know.
That's okay.
With us.
Let's not tell them.
It's our secret.
So when is the Skinny Tire Festival this year?
It's March 10th through the 13th, 4 days. The full festival is 4 days, but we have a weekend special for people that just want to blow in and grab the best of it over the weekend.
And so when exactly is it? And then we'll talk about the specifics of that, those 4 days.
Okay. It actually, we have a kickoff on Friday evening for our top fundraisers. They get treated to a special dinner banquet at one of our great guest houses here in town that rotates around, so it's a great venue. Then the first route actually starts on Saturday, and the last route ends on Tuesday.
Who are you raising funds for?
We're raising funds for about half a dozen different cancer research and survivorship programs.
Oh, cool.
But one of our pet programs, of course, locally, we've constructed a great facility, a new hospital. Within that hospital, our events support a cancer treatment and resource center, a place where regionally people can come and get treated. It's full of connectivity to doctors all over the place, as well as the famous Huntsman Cancer Institute up in Salt Lake. So you can actually get your treatment, sit down, research about your issue online right here, talk with docs, and get, of course, knowledge is power. Get empowered and build your psychology of survivorship right here in town.
That's very cool. Very cool. So we have our dinner on Friday night.
Yeah.
And our first route on Saturday. How long's the first route?
About 60 miles. The first day is out to Dead Horse Point and back.
Okay. And then what goes on Saturday night? Anything special?
Saturday night, actually afternoon, we've got some live music and some great snacks and food and a little bit of discussion, guest speakers that happen to blow into town. Sunday night, we have our cowboy dinner out at a great location right off the Colorado River in the midst of the canyons at Red Cliffs Adventure Lodge. And again, we've got some guest speakers, great dinner, lots of camaraderie and socializing. Monday, of course, is the Pièce de Résistance.
Yes,
here
it
in the
is.
Desert, Arches National Park route. Then Tuesday, we wind it up with a great route down the Colorado River. It's a shorter route to give people the opportunity, you know, for late checkouts at their hotel, get a nice ride in before they start to travel, but finished up with something that's just kind of a spin out after your 3 days of starting off your cycling season. So it's like this is your training. Come out and do it. This isn't something you need to train up for.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you doing your moonlight ride this year?
We are.
See, that's what I want to do. I want to do your moonlight ride. Now, which night is your moonlight ride?
The moonlight ride is on a full moon in May.
Oh, that's a different event.
It is.
Oh, so we could come out twice.
Absolutely.
That's what we
hope for, is to give you all kinds of great things in the desert three times a year.
That would be awesome. How many people are you expecting so far this year? How many have signed up for Skinny Tire this year?
Well, Skinny Tire Festival early registration is actually very strong. We've got close to 400 riders.
Holy smokes.
And so based on how it's working, we're kind of expecting it could be 800-900 riders by the festival, which would be just wonderful.
Do you have a maximum? Do you know that you can only support so many?
No, we can support quite a few. The local businesses are great about that, but we have a maximum of 1,000 riders.
Okay.
And yeah, we kind of put that out there. A lot of our ridership thinks that that preserves a quality cycling experience.
So how many volunteers do you need for this event?
We usually run about 40 to 50 volunteers.
Yeah, they're the best, aren't they?
Oh my gosh, yeah. This, you know, it's a small town, but gosh, no problem whatsoever. Of course, Moab's such a host town. We love them. And, of course, a lot of them are out on the road after they do what they need to do for everybody's service.
I find that volunteers often have as much, if not more fun, than the riders. That's what they tell
me. They do.
They do.
And
they
we give them an extra treat.
Sure.
2 years running, we're working with the Banff Mountain Film Festival.
Nice.
And they coordinate their film festival Monday evening of our ride each year.
Nice.
So that's great.
Yep. Very cool. So tell our listeners how they can find out about the Skinny Tire Festival.
Absolutely. The best way is to go to our website at skinnytireevents.com. Just
okay.
Click on Skinny Tire Festival on the menu, and you'll get the all of the ride descriptions each day, as well as the climb profiles, and also all of the other interesting things about if you're a fundraiser and you really want to make a difference, and you've got some inspiration there. We have a great program to treat you to a lot of extra stuff that says thank you so much. We appreciate your efforts and making a difference in the world.
Well, it just sounds like so much fun. It sounded like fun last year, and you graciously invited me out last year, and I just wasn't able to make it. And I'm not sure. I'm doing so much traveling this year. I'm going to NABS in March and to the Bike
Ooh.
Summit. So I'm not sure. I would love to come out there sometime. And, Mark, I really appreciate you spending time with me this evening on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Well, thanks for letting us chat with you a little bit, and you have a great cycling season. And one of these years, of course, it's always open, Diane. Anytime you want to come, let us know.
I will indeed. Thanks, Mark.
Hey, you're welcome.
Have a good night.
Okay, bye, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Mark Griffith joined us from Moab, Utah, and he's running the Skinny Tire Festival out there.
Telling you, I'm going to do that someday. What a cool-sounding festival this year.
And then later on, the Moonlight Ride.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It is cool.
Well, it's more than cool here.
It's cold.
It's cold.
Thank you very much.
But it won't stay that way long if the recent weather patterns hold, because we seem to be oscillating between some
spring and winter.
Yeah.
Winter and spring. Yeah, it's supposed to warm up again early next week.
Catch those days when you can. Try and time it so your boss will let you have a day off to ride if the weather breaks.
You call in with the flu. I'm sorry, I'm sick.
Got to call in well. I'm entirely too well to come in to work today.
I want to see how that one flies. I'm sorry I'm not coming in today. I feel way too good. I wonder if my boss would like that. That would be me.
Well, I don't know. I think Brian would let you have a day
what
off
mean, Brian?
For wellness. Isn't he, he has something to say about it, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does.
Okay.
Yeah, he does.
All right.
Well, then...
thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show.
You want to know who's on next week?
Sure, if you got a second.
RKP. Red Kite Prayer.
Oh, nice.
Patrick Brady will be with us next week.
Wonderful.
We've been promising to bring him on. He's coming up.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
So you've got that to look forward to, if nothing else.
Like snow and ice.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.